Hello, Cheryl, and hello, everyone, and happy down week. Although I am still working, there's always something about this week between Christmas and New Year's that feels kind of like a down week. You know, it feels more relaxed. I don't know. It feels like the whole world kind of slows down, or at least our country does. So, happy down week. So today when I start sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, the very first question is, what is the nature of the heart? And so I thought I would play a song about the heart. By the way, I am relaxing. It's down week, you know. So I'm not at my desk. I'm relaxing at my purple sofa, which means you're just going to hear the music through my laptop. It won't be through my speakers. But, you know, I'm enjoying down week. So this is a song by Omkara. Oops, I started Safari, which I didn't want to do. Let me close Safari. Safari's been acting up today, so this may take a second. All right. This is a song by Omkara, and it is called Heart of Fire. All right. Lovely song. So as I mentioned, the first question that I'm going to be looking at today from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi is, what is the nature of the heart? And this is on page 23. It's question number 9. And this is Ramana Maharshi's answer. The sacred texts describing it say, between the two nipples, below the chest and above the abdomen, there are 6 organs of different colors, one of them resembling the bud of a water lily and situated 2 digits to the right is the heart. It is inverted and within it is a tiny orifice which is the seat of dense darkness full of desires. All the psychic nerves depend upon it. It is the abode of the vital forces, the mind, and the light of consciousness. But, although it is described thus, the meaning of the word heart is the true self, as it is denoted by the terms existence, consciousness, bliss, eternal, and, here comes a word I don't know, plenum, P-L-E-N-U-M. We'll look that up in a moment. It has no differences such as exterior and interior or up and down. That tranquil state in which all thoughts come to an end is called the state of the true self. When it is realized as it is, there is no scope for discussion about its location inside the body or outside. I'm really happy about this because if you were here last week, you might remember that we had the question, what part of the body is the abode of the self? And I told you that the answer that Ramana Maharshi gave was not an answer at all. Anyhow, he said, well, generally, you know, people say this and some other people say this, but he didn't actually give an answer. You know, and again, I don't know why. Maybe he just felt that the questioner wasn't truly ready for an answer. So he just, you know, said what is generally accepted in the Hindu religion or the Hindu culture. And when this question was asked, what is the nature of the heart? You know, I already know Ramana Maharshi's answer, because I know Ramana Maharshi. And so when Ramana Maharshi started off answering, the sacred text describe it is, I thought, oh, he's not answering again. You know, he's just saying, here's what the texts say. And I knew that that was not his answer because I know him. But then he came to his answer. The second paragraph is really where he gave the true answer. The first answer was just kind of blah, blah, blah. This is, you know, what the texts say. But then he goes on to actually correct the sacred texts, which are just blah, blah, blah. He says, but although it is described thus, the meaning, the real meaning of the word heart is the true self. And as the last sentence says, you know, so when you realize this, you know, there's no scope for discussion about its location inside the body or outside the body, right? It has no location. But, you know, so when we say things like, listen to your heart, we mean listen to that spiritual intuition that it comes from the true self. Right? Follow your heart. Follow the spiritual intuition that comes from your true self. Awaken to the heart. Awaken to your true self. Right? Know your heart. know the true self, right? So this is the meaning of the word heart. And we are going to look up a word here. Some of you may know it. Some of y'all may be more vocabulary smart than me. I'm pretty simple, but it's P-L-E-N-U-M. Okay. Huh. It's an assembly of all the members of a group or committee. That's the first definition. And the second definition is a physics definition, which is the space completely filled with matter, or the whole of space so regarded. And Cheryl says she looked up the word under the Hindi definition. Okay, if you have that, you can give that to us. I'm assuming it's more closely related to this physics definition. A space completely filled with matter, or the whole of space, so regarded. Full space is the Latin literal term for the word full space. So let's look at it with this definition. So, although it is described thus in the sacred texts, the meaning of the word heart is the true self, as it is denoted by the terms existence, consciousness, bliss, eternal, and full space. Kind of reminds me of the everything, nothing, right? The nothing that is everything, full space. So the heart is existence, consciousness, bliss, eternal, full space, which means it has no differences such as exterior and interior. It has no up, no down, right? And you can see that if you really look at this description, no exterior and no interior, right? Existence has no exterior, no interior. Consciousness. Bliss. Eternal and full space. None of them have an interior or an exterior. None of them have an up or a down. He goes on to say that tranquil state in which all thoughts come to an end is called the state of the true self. When it is realized as it is, there is no scope for discussion about its location inside or outside the body. So when he talks about that tranquil state where all thoughts come to an end, he's referring to the end of the ego. And when you come to the end of the ego, the final end of the ego, you then know existence, consciousness, bliss, eternal, full space. You know what those words point to. And once you know what those words point to, obviously, there is no room for discussion about whether it's located inside or outside the body. And he's saying this is what the word heart, when he uses the word heart, this is what the heart refers to. That's his true answer. I knew that was his true answer. At first, I thought he wasn't going to give it. Happy to see that he did. So I'm going to move on to number 10. Why do thoughts of many objects arise in the mind, even when there is no contact with external objects? And so, you know, we don't know. One thing I read once, let me just tell you this. I can't remember where I read it, therefore I do not know if it's true. But I read once that this book is a collection of questions and answers from different conversations, all put together. So it didn't necessarily flow. For example, that question number 9 was from the same questioner as the questioner for question number 8. In fact, they may not have even been on the same day. And so each question could be from a different questioner. So it's not like I am that with Nisargadatta Maharaj, where you have an entire conversation where Nisargadatta is talking to one person and the next question automatically follows from the previous question and was from the same questioner. You know, the person asking number 10 could be a completely different person on a completely different day from number 9. So what that means is we don't have any context for the question. When you're reading I Am That, you get some context. You know, sometimes you have the questioner sitting there telling you about themselves and their, you know, I'm a college student from the USA and I came here because I want help with, right? You get to know what's going on a little bit with the questioner. In this particular book, we don't know that. We don't have any context. When I read the question, however, what arose in me as a possible context, and I have to throw possible because I obviously don't know, is that this person is a person who has tried meditation probably to great lengths. And so they know what it's like to set to disengage from the world and to set for hours in meditation. And they're wondering why, when I'm not involving myself in the world, when I'm attempting to meditate, why do all of these thoughts about the world keep arising? You know, like if I had been in conversation with somebody an hour ago and then went and meditated, well, I could understand why that conversation is now replaying in my mind. You know, I get that. But I haven't been, you know, I've been secluding myself and not engaged in the world, and I attempt to meditate, and there's still all of these thoughts. Why? That's the way I kind of take this question. And again, there's a bit of imagination here because we have no context. But again, this is the question. Why do thoughts of many objects arise in the mind even when there is no contact with external objects? See, it sounds like a person who has been secluding themselves. This is Ramana's answer. All such thoughts are due to latent tendencies. They appear only to the individual consciousness, which has forgotten its real nature and become externalized. Whenever particular things are perceived, the inquiry, who is it that sees them, should be made. They will then disappear at once. All right, so the first part of the answer to the question, all thoughts are due to latent tendencies, is one half of the answer. The other half of the answer is they appear only to the individual consciousness. And the word, the Hindi word that is used here is jiva. That would be the individual soul, or the apparent separate being. So what Ramana Maharshi is really saying is that these thoughts are showing up because you are still identified with the person. And as long as you are identified with the person, I mean, the subconscious of the person, especially if you think about the jiva, the individual soul, which possibly has reincarnated, you know, hundreds if not thousands of times, there's an awful lot of subconscious available to the jiva, to the individual soul. And so the fact that you've been in seclusion for 10 days or a year or whatever, as long as you are still identified with the person, there's still plenty of jiva subconscious, individual soul subconscious, to just create all kinds of thoughts. And, you know, Michael Langford talks about this, not in this exact way, but he talks about this in The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. He talks about how the ego can put thoughts together, you know, and just create trillions of different ideas. And in fact, you all, if you're in the Gentle Healing group, you have a tip that's coming very soon. It's coming this week sometime, about a dream I had the other night. And when I woke up, I was granted the grace of seeing without any effort where every detail of my dream came from in my subconscious. I saw it very easily and very quickly, like, oh, that's this person said this to me and that person said that. And I remember this from my childhood and all this stuff from my subconscious, stuff I wasn't consciously walking around thinking about, got put together and created this something new. And so that's what Ramana is saying here, is that you have all of these latent tendencies, or you have all of these ideas in your subconscious, and they can be reborn to create new ideas and new daydreams and new stories just endlessly, right? Trillions of different ideas can be put together from what's in your subconscious. It seems endless. And this will continue to occur for as long as you are identified with the person. And then he gives a solution. So that was the answer to the question, why do these thoughts arise, even though, you know, I'm in seclusion, even though I have no contact with external objects? Why are these thoughts all happening all the time? That was the answer. You know, they're in your subconscious, and they are coming up because you're identified with the person. But then he gives the solution, what to do about it. Whenever particular things are perceived, the inquiry, who is it that sees them, should be made. They will then disappear at once. And if you're in gentle healing, in a way, we practiced this last night. We didn't practice it with thoughts as much. We practiced it with sensations in the body. You know, we might have taken the time in that, I called it a sample meditation. We might have taken the time in that sample meditation to notice a particular sensation, like my back. I can feel my back against the blue sofa. And I may have spent some time really just noticing that sensation. And then I ask, what is it that sees this? Right? What is it that sees this? Yeah, Kathy is saying her stiff shoulder and neck. So, again, the way that I showed you guys last night, the way that I play with this, that's what I consider it as playing. The way that I would play with this is first I would just notice my stiff shoulder and neck without judgment or complaint, just paying attention to what it feels like, you know, with that curiosity, right? Just kind of look at what a stiff shoulder and neck feels like without any preconceived notions. And then after spending a few seconds or a minute examining it, then I ask, what is it that sees this? And in that question, what is it that sees this? I turn the attention towards awareness or towards the true self. And so this is really useful, especially if we are talking about a person who is so motivated that he's taking his time to seclude himself in some way and he's not involved with the world. You know, now he can go back to his seclusion after being with Ramana Maharshi. And when he closes his eyes and these, you know, sugar plum fairies start dancing in his head again, right? These, I remember I used to always see purple elephants. Isn't that funny? I don't anymore. I haven't in a long time, but I bet you a dollar I do tomorrow because I said it. But I would close my eyes into meditation, and this is when I used to fall asleep pretty quickly. But like I always knew when I was falling asleep when I started seeing purple elephants. I don't know. I'm going under. But so if the purple elephants start showing up, then what he does is he goes ahead and pays attention to the purple elephant for a moment, and then asks, what sees this purple elephant? And turns the attention back to himself. You know, or if the thought is, oh my God, I've been sitting in this cave for weeks and nothing is happening. And then pause for a moment and just notice that thought. I've been sitting in this cave for weeks and nothing is happening. And then ask, what sees this thought? What hears this thought? What pays attention to this thought? Right? Any of those types of questions. I call that bouncing off of. That's my own little individual term. I bounce off of whatever appears, whatever I hear. You know, if there's birds outside and I'm listening to the birds outside, I'll listen to them for a moment and then I bounce off of them by saying, what is it that, she's calling me Tigger, I think that's funny. What is it that hears these birds? And when I do that, it's like I bounce off the sound and turn my attention back to the self. So I can bounce off a thought, I can bounce off a pain, I can bounce off a sound. In that way, anything that arises while I'm meditating is just an opportunity to turn my attention back to the self. It's the opposite of a distraction if I use it in the way that he's describing. If I bounce off of it by saying, what sees this? Right? What is looking? What is noticing? What hears? Right? All of those questions really have the same effect. So again, the questioner asked, why do thoughts of many objects arise in the mind even when there is no contact with external objects? The answer, all such thoughts are due to latent tendencies. They appear only to the individual consciousness, the jiva, which has forgotten its real nature and become externalized, right? By the way, I didn't comment on that. The fact that the jiva or the individual soul has forgotten its real nature is something that you all are very well aware of. But the externalized comment means the attention is habitually focused outward. Right? It has forgotten its true self and the attention points outward. And thoughts are actually outward. Right? They may be inside the skin, but they're considered outward from the true self. So, again, what he is also saying here is because you are still attached to the idea that you are the person, your attention is habitually out, and since your attention is out, something appears for you to look at. Right? You're sitting there looking out, so things begin to appear. Purple elephants begin to show up. And so again, you need to learn to turn the attention inward towards the awareness. And that's why I call it bouncing off of, right? You bounce off of those purple elephants and turn the attention back in. So it's almost like the attention is going out, it hits something, and then when you say, who sees this? The attention turns around and goes back in. And then you can rest with the attention inward. So, all such thoughts are due to latent tendencies. They appear only to the individual consciousness, the jiva, which has forgotten its real nature and become externalized. Whenever particular things are perceived, the inquiry, who is it that sees them, should be made. They will then disappear at once. Yeah, and Kathy is pointing out that her mind wants to think there is also going to be something to see within. Yeah. Yeah, and as you guys know, I am reading a couple of books by Bernadette Roberts. And she talks about the disappointing discovery that our ideas of God and our ideas of bliss and our ideas of ecstasy are not the truth. And so we go searching for our ideas and that's not what we find. And again, if we're really attached to our ideas, then there's this disappointment that occurs because what we're finding is truth and not our ideas. And Kathy says that's actually comforting. I think it's wonderful to know that there may be disappointments and what feel like dry periods along the way and just keep going, keep going, keep going, right? I noticed Cheryl is saying she looked up Bernadette on YouTube. There's not much there. And in fact, from what I understand, there's nothing there. any Bernadette that you find in YouTube, from what at least what it says on her webpage, is not her. I haven't looked. I just trusted her webpage when it said she is not on YouTube, although some people say she is. That's not her. That's what her webpage says. And also, I may have mentioned to you that within 2 weeks of me discovering her, within 2 weeks of me being guided, when I asked Ramana over there, I say over there because I was literally talking to his picture and it's over there. So when I felt Ramana guide me to read a book and I asked, you know, who can I trust, and was told Bernadette Roberts, that was 2 weeks before she dropped the body, 2 weeks before she passed away. Isn't that interesting? So she passed away, I think, on November 27th. And I think it was around November 14th. I could go look at my calendar, but it was mid-November, right around the 14th, when I was guided to her. So I found that very, very interesting. But that gives her the opportunity to also guide me, doesn't it? While I'm engrossed in her material, she is now free and available to guide me through it. Where in body, I don't know. Maybe still, but I don't know. So, the next question then, how do the triple factors, it's kind of interesting reading a book when the questioners are steeped in a religious training that I have not been steeped in, because some of their questions are like, what the heck? But fortunately here they tell us what the triple factors are. The triple factors are the knower, the known, and the knowledge. So as an example, in the little, trivia that I just shared, that, Bernadette Roberts dropped the body 2 weeks after I was guided to her, right? that was nice of her. So she could help me out. That was really nice of her. But the knower would be I, Regina. The known is Bernadette, right? And the knowledge is that she dropped the body on November 27th, right? There's a knower, a known, and a knowledge. Cheryl is asking, did I actually hear her name? And the answer is yes. I asked, who can I trust? And I heard Bernadette Roberts. And I actually, and just to let you know, so it doesn't sound overly mystically mysterious, I had her book on my bookshelf. It had been sitting there for, I don't know how many years. I'm going to guess 4 years without me reading it. A friend had mentioned her book to me a long time ago. And every year at Christmas, Ron asks me what I want. And the truth is, I never want anything. I always say, the hardest assignment I get each year is creating a Christmas list. Because Ron loves Christmas. And he loves to give gifts. But he wants to make sure they're gifts that we want. So he wants us to create a list. And so, yeah, I had a mountain of gifts. I did. I do every year. One year, my back actually went out, bending over and picking up my gifts repeatedly. My back went out. That's how many gifts I had. But each year around Thanksgiving, he asks Jasmine and me to create a Christmas list. And we know he wants what he considers a good list with a lot of really good stuff on it. And I always have trouble. You know, I have so much trouble because I just don't want anything. It's always, it's the hardest assignment every year coming up with my Christmas list. But one year, several years ago, a friend had just mentioned this book to me, and she had mentioned that Bernadette Roberts was a contemplative, and I am kind of a contemplative type. So knowing nothing about the book, I put that on my Christmas list. And so Ron bought it for me, and again, this was probably 4 years ago. And I opened the book at some point and, again, just didn't find any interest in it. You know, read just a few pages, found no interest in it, and put it back on the bookshelf and went about forgetting about it. So So in that way, it was forgotten about. But of course, still there, right, at some level. And so when I asked, who do I trust? And I heard Bernadette Roberts, you know, there was something in the subconscious already where that could be pulled up. And in fact, there was one book there already. But I also knew almost as soon as I grabbed that book that it wasn't that book alone, that there was another book, a partner book that I also needed. And I went onto Amazon, and there are a few Bernadette Roberts books there. And I purely used intuition because, of course, I didn't know what I was looking for specifically. And I just kind of felt that this other book called What is the Self was the partner book. And indeed, the two go together very well. And I think that without the two, you do not have a full picture of what she's talking about. You only have like half a picture. So that's how that came about. But we digress. Let's get back to our question. How do the triple factors, the knower, the known, and the knowledge, which are absent in deep sleep, samadhi, etc., manifest themselves in the self in the states of waking and dreaming? Oh, that's a good question. So again, how do the knower, the known, and the knowledge, which are not there at all in deep sleep without dreams, not there at all in deep meditation called samadhi, right? How do they show up during the day when we're awake and during our dreams? That's the curious question that is being asked. And so here is the answer. Okay, good. It's not that long. It has big words in it, so I wanted to peek ahead and see if it was like a whole page of big words. From the self, and this being the jiva or the ego self, right? From the self, there arise in succession. Number one, reflected consciousness, which is a kind of luminosity. That's the first thing to arise, reflected consciousness. The second thing to arise, the jiva or individual consciousness, which could be called the seer or the first concept. And then the third thing to arise is the phenomena, that is the world. That's the answer. And what I find really interesting, you know, it's funny that I went through this long, I thought I was digressing, this long thing about, you know, how I came to be assigned Bernadette Roberts. One thing that's really interesting about her book is that she refers to consciousness as the reflexive mechanism. Let me type that in. Reflexive mechanism. The reflexive mechanism. And she says true awakening, awakening to the true self, which she calls the no self. But this true awakening is when the reflexive mechanism ends. She doesn't use the word ego. And so what's really interesting here, notice that word reflexive. What's really interesting here is that Ramana Maharshi says the first thing to arise is reflected consciousness. Those words are extremely similar, don't you think? Reflexive mechanism, reflected consciousness. It's what she says is the last thing to go, the final awakening. And it's what Ramana says is the first thing to arise. So why don't we go to our friendly dictionary? So, reflexive. Okay, reflexive. First of all, in grammar, denotes a pronoun that refers back to the subject. It refers back to the subject, a reflexive pronoun. Also, it is performed as a reflex without conscious thought. And she talks about that. She talks about how we have no control over this reflexive mechanism. We can't decide not to be reflexive. And notice that reflex means refers back to the subject, right? So it's referring back to the subject without conscious thought. Also, taking account of itself. So the way that we experience with ego, because I think each of us still has ego, so let's go from what we know rather than imagining what it's like to be beyond the ego and still experiencing consciousness. From within the ego, the way we experience this reflexive mechanism is by always thinking about me, comparing to me, right? Oh, she's taller than I am. She's smarter than me. Oh, I'm smarter than her, right? Everything that we experience in some way, we automatically refer back to ourselves, the subject. And this happens without consciously deciding to. It's not like I look at someone and say, I'm going to now compare her to me, right? We don't consciously decide to now compare her to me. It just happens. We just do it. Right? It's something that's going on automatically all the time. It's what the ego does. And in fact, from what she says, it's even what consciousness does beyond the ego, although it's different when the ego is taken out of it. The ego really meaning the wrong mind alone here. When the wrong mind is taken out of it and there's only a right mind, the reflexiveness, it has a different quality about it. But there's still this constant referring back to self and referring back to my experience of oneness, right? My experience of love. It's still this is constantly going on. So that's the reflexive mechanism. And let's go ahead and look up reflected. So reflected is a throwback. Is the first definition. For example, reflected heat, light, or sound. It is thrown back. It also reflected can be a representation, like when you look in a mirror, you see a representation of you, right? You don't see you. You see a representation of you. It's a reflection, right? So that's another definition here. Another definition is to think deeply or carefully about. Recently in a tip, I referred to consciousness, interestingly, as being like a mirror, a living mirror. Some of you may remember this tip. I said it's like a living mirror. And although this is just a story, but you forgot the quote that we're contemplating. The quote is, the question was, how do the triple factors, the knower, the known, and knowledge, arise? And Ramana said that there are three things that arise in succession. The first thing is reflected consciousness, which is a kind of luminosity. Right? So that's what we're looking at, is this reflected consciousness, a kind of luminosity. So in the story that I shared with you all in the tip, and again, it is just a story, but in this story, the idea of, the true self does not have a reflexive mechanism or does not have a mirror in which to see itself, a reflective mechanism. It doesn't have either. And so an idea arose in the true self, a curiosity, we could call it, but the idea was, you know, wanting to know itself. And out of this idea of wanting to know itself, consciousness came into being. Consciousness being like a living mirror in which itself could be seen. You see, that's the reflexive mechanism. It can see itself. It's the reflective mechanism. Itself, it can see itself. It has that ability to look and see what I am. Now, in the story, however, once this a mirror arose, instead of the mirror just looking and seeing the true self in the mirror, it was kind of on an outward journey, and it started looking outward to try and find something to reflect. And again, this is where the ego was born, the individual self and the world and all of that by looking out. And then consciousness became engrossed in these images in the mirror, and consciousness started thinking, oh, I'm that. You know, I'm Regina, I'm Kathy, I'm, you know, Carrie, right? I'm that. And now on the return journey, you know, we're learning to do what the mirror was intended to do in the first place. What consciousness was intended to do in the first place was look and see the true self reflected. So we're learning to look back within and find the true self. But you see, that itself is a reflexive mechanism, right? We're looking within, that ability to look within and find the true self and rest with the true self that we call awareness, watching awareness, could not happen if it were not for consciousness, the reflexive mechanism, or what he's calling the reflected consciousness. It has that ability to look and see itself. So he is also saying this is the first thing that arises, is this ability to look and see the self. It's the first, you could call it the first creation. The Course calls it the Son of God. Then, once this reflected consciousness, which pure, you know, it's pure at this point, so he says it's a kind of luminosity, because it's very pure. And again, when we're waking up, reversing this process, and we wake up to consciousness, we wake up to what the Course calls true perception, or the real world. It's very pure. Right? So this is the first creation, was this reflected consciousness. And then he says what comes next is the jiva, the individual consciousness, which he calls the seer or the first concept. And as we know, in many other places, he calls it the I thought. There's an I, there's a me, a subject, you know. Once this subject arises, he says, out of that, the entire world arises next. So that's his answer to the question. Again, the question was, how do the triple factors, knower, known, and knowledge, which are absent in deep sleep and samadhi, manifest themselves in the self in the states of waking and dreaming? And he says, first, what arises is this reflected consciousness, which is a kind of luminosity. But then what arises is the individual consciousness, or the first concept, I. And then what arises is any phenomena, the world, whether it's the world you see, you know, during the waking day, or whether it's the world that you see at night when you're asleep in your dream. It only arises after the I, which also means in reverse that once the I ends, the world would also end. There would be no world without an I, assuming this progression is true. Without a subject, there is no object. And even without getting mystical about it, let's pretend like for a moment. that's what Nisargadatta talked about, yes. But let's pretend like for a moment, let's forget all this spiritual stuff for a moment. Let's pretend like all we are is human beings. Join me in this pretending. And at the end of life, all there is, you know, death, what we imagine death to be, the end, right? You can imagine, if you imagine this mortality, that at least for me, that when I die, there is no longer a world. You can see that I, the subject, even in a purely mortal situation without any spiritual teaching at all, that without me as a subject, there is no world. The subject is required for the world to appear, at least in my individual situation. Once I'm dead, there is no world, right? And in fact, we experience that nightly, which is what the questioner is speaking about, when we are in deep sleep, not the streaming sleep, but deep sleep. And the eye really, the way Ramana describes deep sleep is he says the eye returns to the heart when we're in deep sleep. The eye concept, the eye thought returns to the heart. So when the eye returns to the heart in deep sleep, there is no world. No eye, no world. Of course, when we wake up in the morning time, I wake up. I open my eyes and there's a world. But not only that, in the dream, have you ever had a dream at night without an eye? Now, in most of my dreams, I am Regina. I have had a few dreams where I was another character. You know, once I was this 15-year-old boy, and I think once I was a captain of a ship. So on rare instances, I've had dreams where I was someone other than Regina. But in every single dream, there's always an I. I've never just had this dream happen without a me in the dream. So even without going into the mystical teaching that is going on here, we have enough evidence from our limited experiences to see that whenever we are experiencing a world, whether it's this world that we experience while we're awake and walking around, or whether it's the world when we're asleep and dreaming, there is always an I present when there is a world present. We can at least verify that part to be true. We have never, in wake or dream, experienced a world without an eye. And that's what Ramana is saying. That's also what Bernadette Roberts says, and that's what Michael Langford says, and that's what Nisargadatta says. So, assuming that is true, and again, we have at least enough evidence to at least put some faith there, because it's the only experience we know, actually. We only know of an I and a world. We don't know of a world without an I. So, assuming that what the teachers are telling us is true, this would mean that when the I disappears, the world disappears, which is, as we know, the teachings of A Course in Miracles as well. And of course, it's one of those teachings that people really like to argue. Well, that's not really what it means. But we keep running into the same teaching over and over again. You know, we have here Ramana Maharshi, who you can't really say he was Hindu. He was really non-religious when he had his awakening experience. But then he studied the Hindu texts afterwards. So his tradition that he's speaking from is Hindu. His culture was Hindu. You know, we have A Course in Miracles, who was given to Helen Schuckman, who was born Jewish, raised by a Baptist nanny, and was a closet Catholic. A completely different culture, right? Bernadette Roberts, who was raised as a very strong doubting Catholic, did become a nun for a time, but ended up leaving and having four children, and really was just a homemaker most of her life. You know, just, you know, you just get these different people from these different cultures, different times, different spiritual paths that follow it all the way to the conclusion, don't even know about each other, and they speak the same truth. And again, it's not a truth that we can entirely verify from our experience now, but we can at least partially verify it and say there may be something here. It's true. I've never had a dream without me, a subject. So maybe me is required. And not only that, I don't know much about science. I'm not a big science buff, but I have seen a little bit on quantum mechanics. And scientists say this is true too. Scientists that study quantum mechanics, they have all these little experiments they've used to, quote, prove it, although I don't understand. It's over my head. But they say that in order to have an object, a subject is required. They say the same thing, which means without the subject, there would be no world. And I think most of us do know that the teaching about letting go of ego is the teaching of letting go of the subject, letting go of the I, the death of the ego, right? That's the spiritual path that we have put our feet upon, which means we are also on the path of the disappearance of the world. Now, of course, what Bernadette Roberts says and what everybody else says is something else arises in its place, and that's reality, right? What we see when we don't see the world is reality. So there's not this great void, although there may be a void experienced in transition. Some experience a void for a very brief time. Some experience a void for a longer period of time. But that is only a transition phase. So my time is up, but what I leave us with is a consistency of teaching across cultures and times of individuals who have not studied one another. And so to them, I say we should open our mind and walk our own journey and find out if what they say is true from our own experience. I'm not into this believing crap, maybe having enough faith to find out for myself. There's no reason to believe anyone. We need to find out. And with that, I release the mic. Happy New Year, everyone.